Good afternoon and welcome to the program. My name is Jerry Boyer and you're listening to American Entrepreneur Radio on 1360 WMNY. Now, the guest you're about to hear has a voice that you've heard before. Ron Manners has been a guest on the program recently, a few weeks ago, and just is a wealth of knowledge and experience and someone that I think we're going to want to keep talking to. For numerous reasons. Now, when I first ran across Ron, I was interested in the fact that he ran a free market educational foundation in Australia, the Mankell Educational Foundation. He was referred by a mutual friend, and he was helpful in giving me a sense of what's going on in terms of the March of Freedom in the part of the world where he lives. But in looking into Ron's life story, I found out that he is a miner, a lifelong miner, and the son of a miner, and a very successful gold miner. And since gold has become an extremely important commodity in the modern world of fiat currency, I thought it would be helpful to talk to Ron and get a sense from him of the dynamics of this extremely important investment from the supply side. Almost all of the discussion of gold is from the demand side. Why we demand it, why we need it, why it's better than fiat money. But there's almost no discussion from the supply side, and I think that's missing, and I think it would be very helpful. So, first of all, Ron, welcome back to American Entrepreneur Radio.
It's a pleasure, Jerry, and nice to be talking to you and your listeners. I wish I could hear your listeners speak back.
Well, I have to think about how we can arrange that. We've got a time zone problem. I think you'd have to talk in the middle of the night for us to do live radio. I don't know. If you ever visit the United States, maybe, and you're in this time zone, then perhaps we could make something like that work. All right. Let's you just were inducted quite recently into the Australian Mining Hall of Fame. And so this is an industry that you've basically spent your entire life in, and your father was a miner, right? I mean, didn't he start off as was it your father or your grandfather who was a prospector?
Oh, it goes way back, Jerry. It goes back beyond my father. My grandfather was a mining engineer, and his father, which is my great grandfather, was one of the original prospectors in Victoria, what they call in Ballarat, which was the gold mining centre back in 1854, and he was one of the prospectors that got involved in the famous Eureka Stockade, where it's the only tax revolt that Australia has ever had, and I'm proud that my great grandfather had some trouble with the authorities. It established a very high mark for me to follow.
So you're a fourth generation gold miner.
Sure.
So talk to me a little bit about the dynamics of this. I think there's a general perception, which I believe is wrong, that essentially the extraction industries are largely a matter of just owning the property, and after that, you know, it's dumb luck whether you find the mineral, and that once you found it, you just pump it out of the ground if it's gas or oil, or you dig it out of the ground if it's a metal, and that these are industries that do not have strong productivity gains coming from technology and innovation. I mean, I hear that when people talk about these industries. That's not true, is it?
Jerry, I'm not sure where to start answering that question, because it's a big question. I think that the steps, there's exploration, which is the creative discovery process, and that's followed by the actual mining, which is quite a science in itself, and then the production of the actual ore, whether it be gold or nickel or gas. And then the fourth step is the marketing. And the marketing, and whether you use derivatives or forward selling and all sorts of risk protective devices that are quite often used these days to smooth down the volatility of the markets as we see supply and demand out of balance from time to time. So there really are four quite separate, and they require different types of people with different mentalities. But if I can just touch briefly on the on the exploration side, which I think is the creative side of the whole business of mining, where a prospector, and they're highly technical people. These are not bushies with ragged hats and stuff. These are technical people. Most of their research is done in the office on the computer and data generation packages. They go out and they acquire some land, maybe their land themselves, or maybe other land of other people if it's a joint venture. And they've got a hunch. They've developed a technical theory where there might be an ore reserve to be found. And they go out and they use all this technology, whether it be airborne magnetic surveys or might be helicopter low-level magnetic surveys over the land. And they gather this and they sometimes superimpose the computer-generated profiles and contours from that on other contours that they've generated by taking soil samples to get the chemical analysis. And when they find one anomaly, overlays another anomaly, this is almost the time when they say, let's drill there, let's solve our curiosity of creating what is creating that anomaly that maybe 100 meters, we measure in meters, but you can think of them as yards, I suppose, beneath the surface, sometimes beneath wind-blown sand where there's no telltale, there's no exposure. Australia particularly is such an old geological land that there's not a lot of rock outcrop.
That's a good point. In many parts you might have, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles that look identical to one another. So you've got to, in essence, look beneath the surface. Let's hold that thought and go to a quick break and come back. We're talking about gold exploration, gold mining from the supply side. If you're a gold investor, this is a part of the picture you have to look at, and not a lot of gold investors do. But I'm going to give you a little edge with my friend Ron Manners from the Mankel Economic Educational Foundation. I'm Jerry Boyer. You're listening to American Entrepreneur, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. This is, of course, the American Entrepreneur on Money Talk 1360 WMNY. My guest is Ron Manners. Ron is the head of the Mankel. Am I pronouncing that right?
Well, I would just pronounce it Mankel.
Mankel.
Just equal accent on both the syllables.
Mankel Educational Foundation.
Yep. The original, the name Mankel came. It's an old traditional thing in our family company. The man is MANN is short, is the half, first half of man is my family name, uh-huh. And the KAL is the first half of Kalgoorlie, where our mining, most of our early mining occurred in Western Australia. So the Mankel is just Manners Kalgoorlie abbreviated.
I see, it's a splice.
That's where that came from.
And so the foundation is a free market economics foundation, but yep. You're not.
And we've sent Jerry. Right. We've totaled it up the other day. We found we've sent 400 young, very bright young people to internships, to economic courses, or to various events, either internationally or around Australia. And these 400 young people have come back and they've formed a bit of a network of their own, and they're quite, we've got up to 10 of them working for us at any one time on a part-time basis, inputting all sorts of documents and policy studies and making all sorts of comments and training me on effective use of social networking like Facebook, where I've got about 4,500 friends, and it's just voted the Ron Manners Facebook page is one of the most effective economic and policy Facebook sites in Australia, and it's a seething mass of economic and policy comment that's certainly worth a visit.
And I'm one of your Facebook friends, as a matter of fact, so I'm enjoying what I'm reading there. How is the Freedom Network doing in Australia? Is it growing? Is there a kind of a grassroots movement, sort of back towards economic freedom, or is the welfare state still unchallenged in the debates in Australia?
I think because of the overwhelming danger being becoming obvious from the welfare state, that there is a rapidly increasing interest in free market think tanks, and we're getting more inquiries, we're getting more emails, we're getting more young people coming to us. They say, this is fantastic. These are ideas, and these are things we can't talk about at university. Their lecturers discourage discussion. It used to be a time when universities were an area of active debate and questioning and reasoning, but it's not so anymore. That they realise they have to pass their exams. They realise a lot of the stuff they're being taught economically is just not correct, but they must pass their exams, and I encourage them to do so. And I think they enjoy. There's been a Mises seminar run in Sydney recently, which was an amazing event. So people are looking beyond the simple remedies given to them to solve today's problems. It's the young people that realise that it's a lot of nonsense. If the problem is too much debt, how can the solution be more debt?
Right.
It's the young people that question the nonsense of this. The older generation think that's good as long as they receive the stimulus.
Yes.
That they think that's fine.
Right. Well, but, I think young people have to wake up to the fact that these. Public pension plans are in fact being built on their backs. And although there might be a sort of a hipness, a hip or a coolness factor to leftism among young people who voted in mass, for instance, for candidate Obama, they're footing the bill. So there's a point at which you say, I don't care, how hip it is. This is bad for me, and this is against my self-interest. I want to go back, however, to the mining issue. We've seen just an explosion of paper money around the world in response to the credit crisis of 2007-2008. The United States has been debasing its currency, and a lot of the world is following us down. Even the countries around the world that aren't officially pegged to the dollar do tend to devalue when we devalue. So you've got basically global monetary devaluation. That is pushing people towards gold. Does the gold industry have the kind of agility to up production? Can they sort of keep pace with that? Or are we going to see the kind of production gains, discontinuous high-level production gains which threaten the price of gold? I mean, gold. There's a demand factor to gold. There's a supply factor to gold. I think I've got a pretty good sense of the demand factor, but I don't have much of a sense of the supply factor.
I think the supply factor is what's overlooked is that the bigger companies, the bigger gold producing companies, are experiencing difficulty in replacing the reserves that as they're mining. They're mining at a faster rate than they're replacing them by exploration. And it's an undisputable fact that the bigger companies are not very good at exploring. The creativity that requires the discovery process really comes out of the smaller companies or the individuals, the really entrepreneurs, and the bigger companies are a little bit like government departments. Entrepreneurship doesn't thrive in the bigger companies. So there's been a tremendous push from the bigger companies to acquire, through merger and acquisition, to acquire the smaller companies. So they let the small entrepreneurial companies make the discovery, and then the bigger companies then pounce on them. And that the pond is drying up. And I think there is a really serious supply problem in the gold, and that plus the fact that the governments all over the world love printing paper to pay for their promises, printed paper, paper money, those two factors really guarantee a longer term, very serious increase in the price of gold, which is another way of saying it guarantees a decrease in the value of paper
right.
money.
Well, I suppose the miner could never keep up with the printer, right? I mean, it's unrealistic to think that no matter how great the productivity gains, the gold miner could never keep up with the wild, undiscipline of the central banks.
We are disciplined by reality.
Yes, and they're not. They live in a world of unreality. But I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how far behind, and what I'm hearing from you is that we've got serious supply problems. And I guess I'd like to get a sense of how those arise. I understand the dynamic that you're talking about. Exploration is creative, it's entrepreneurial, and so the big companies can't do it. For instance, in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, 5 or 10 smart guys get together, or gals, they get together and they work and they develop some new breakthrough. And then a giant pharmaceutical company buys them and takes it, you know, the rest of the way. So there's a kind of entrepreneurial phase, and then there's an acquisition phase. And you're saying that that's true in the gold mining industry. I guess I'm trying to get a sense. Why is the entrepreneurial phase having trouble keeping up with the acquisition phase? Are we running out of gold? Or is there something, I mean, is actually a resource depletion problem? Or is there some government intervention or something that's keeping the explorers from finding?
You're going to get me started on some of my I could say favorite concerns.
Well, go.
But and I'll just talk from the Australian point of view. One of our biggest problems is land access, or access to land to explore. And Jerry, generally in Australia, if you and I went out and we pegged or staked some ground on which to explore, it may be that we wouldn't live long enough to get to drill a hole in it. And,
why?
And the land access is caused by a whole raft of problems. One is the thing that's called the Native Title Act, which unfortunately didn't give our Aborigines any real title to the land, but it gave them a license to obstruct and get in the way, so that it's a real obstacle.
So it's a property rights. You're talking about a property rights problem.
Yeah, it's a very serious property rights. The other problem is the extreme, what we call the dark green environmentalist movement, that just have a. They really are devoted. They've devoted their lives to make sure that nothing happens, that nothing is produced, that nothing moves at all, and the combination of the Native Title Act and the very serious environmental problems has driven so many Australian explorers off into other countries. And I can go. I travel the world. I can't go to an airport anywhere in the world without meeting some Australian geologists that I know, and they're all busily out there. They can arrive in particularly some of the African countries. They almost get a red carpet treatment.
Yes.
They can acquire ground one day and they can actually be drilling it the very next day.
I'm trying to get a sense of how global these problems are. So in, let's say, the developed world, it's probably not just Australia, I assume Canada, United States, where you can afford the foolish luxury of excessive environmental regulation. I assume in the developed world you've got a lot of this red tape, but in the hungry third world they're more open to exploitation of those resources. Do I have that right?
I think they're more open and they're sort of more entrepreneurial themselves in their attitudes. They can immediately see the benefits of productivity increasing amongst their population, and the mining industry is incredibly good at training people. And I've been involved in mining in throughout Australia and Mexico, and you can move into the countryside where there's a whole heap of completely unskilled labor, and these are the people that you rely on to get your production up, to get the mine up and running and into production. And you have to train your own people. So
that's a very good point. Let me break in. We need to go to a break. And by the way, we're facing that same problem where I am in Western Pennsylvania, where we've found enormous reservoir of natural gas. And we're trying to get people trained and ready to do that extraction. and having trouble getting people, and they're not trained in the schools for this. So, you know, these companies have to do the training themselves. All right, let's take a quick break. We're going to come back in just a moment, and we're going to talk with Ron Manners from Mancow, which is a gold mining company in Australia. He's also the head of a free market think tank, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to the program. My name is Jerry Boyer. You're listening to The American Entrepreneur on Money Talk 1360, WMNY. And I know a lot of, probably the investment that people ask me about more than any other investment is gold. It's, you know, yeah, people talk about the stock market once in a while or the bond market, but there's a certain thing going on in the public mind about gold that makes it a topic of intense interest. I've done a lot of sort of mathematical analysis of gold prices myself, and by the grace of God, I've gotten a few calls right. But I've mainly looked at it from the standpoint of the demand for gold, which is largely a matter of the excess creation of paper money. But to be honest with you, I don't really understand the supply, or I didn't before this interview. I'm beginning to get a sense of what's going on in the supply of gold. But with any asset, it's a factor of supply and demand. Okay, so Ron, you're saying that there's some parts of the world where it's almost impossible to go exploring for gold, especially the developed world. There's some parts in the world, especially maybe the third world, they're hungry, they can't afford foolishness, they don't have time and energy for it, where it's easier to explore for gold. What about, give me a sense of is resource depletion an issue? You know, Julian Simon said, we're not going to run out of natural resources. We're just going to get better and better at finding them. And that's certainly been true for a lot of assets. It sounds to me like we have a supply disruption problem due to government intervention, not that we're not struggling with an inherent limits to growth when it comes to gold. Do I have that right?
I think you're right. I knew Julian Simon, and I'm a great fan of his writings and theories. He was exactly right on this, and the Australian government in particular has not realised how portable people and capital are, and if they create obstacles, the people, the trained personnel, and the capital are simply on the next plane out.
I see.
Because they are so welcome in so many countries. And I did an analysis at the Mines and Money conference in Hong Kong earlier this year, and the Australian explorers, the mid-size explorers, they all based in Australia, they are spending 85% of their exploration budget outside of Australia.
I see. And there's gold in other places. So and it's not just that the capital and the people are portable, but there's gold out there. I mean, it's not that there's a lot of it probably in the crust of the earth. You know, people can go and find it. And if we won't let people mine for it in the United States, or your government won't let people mine for it or explore for it in Australia, those aren't the only places where gold is present. It's present throughout the earth's crust.
Sure. And the new technologies have made it so, have been absolutely necessary. Let's assume that all the alluvial surface gold deposits have been discovered in the world, which is not true, but let's assume that. So we rely entirely on technology, and the technology now is at the stage where there's a phrase we use, we call it the glass earth. So that you can imagine the globe, the world as a globe, and the first kilometer depth of the whole earth is glass, so we can see through it. And this is what technology has given us, the ability to see through the first kilometer thickness of the earth's crust. So we get an idea of the structures and the deposits that may lie underneath. With these technologies, we can go anywhere in the world and make discoveries, because our guys, our geologists and our prospectors are so good.
What are you using to see? Is it sound waves and sonar effect, or is it infrared, or is it temperature variations? What do you use to look a kilometer into the ground?
Yeah, a lot of those things that started off being magnetics, and there's radiometrics. There's all there's all manner of technologies, all airborne, all flown, and they put all this stuff together, and you can read what's happening underneath all this wind-blown sand everywhere.
I see. So the drones, airplanes, helicopters, maybe satellites, they peer down, they look at the magnetic dissonances, the magnetic anomalies, they look at temperature anomalies.
A lot of this flying has been done, and the data collection has been done by Australian companies. So if I was to go to any country, I'd make three phone calls to the people in Australia who specialise in compiling all this data, and I would buy their airborne flown data sheets covering the specific geographical area that I'm going to go and explore, and I'd pull all their data together, and before I got off the plane at that end, I'd have a very sound picture of what to go looking for.
I see. So the people who are doing the scans may not be that might not actually be the exploration company.
It never is, because it's a highly specialized. All these specific fields are highly specialized, and they stay with their specialization. And you pay a lot of money for those data sets, for those areas that you wish to explore on, but it's money well spent.
You know, I've been encouraging my kids to study economics and finance. Maybe I should nudge some of them towards geology. It looks like we're going to have permanently high demand for gold, because we're in a fiat money frenzy right now. How sensitive is the industry to those kind of price differentials? In other words, if when gold is $400 an ounce versus what it is at the time of this interview, a little less than $1,700 an ounce, do you ramp up production and exploration because of that higher price, or is that exploration process relatively price inelastic?
I think there's a natural rhythm to exploration. At the rate at which you create new reserves, so there's, and that's, you find that with the team you've got, with the facilities you've got, and with the capital backing, you get into a comfort zone, and you try to match the production, so that you've always got. Ideally, it'd be nice to have 5 years production reserves in front of you, so that you can balance out your production, but you don't. There's no race to exhaust your reserves just because the price goes up, because this takes time. If you wanted to increase production, you make a decision today to increase production, it would be a year before that extra production came out of the system, because you'd have to order more ball mills and more rod mills. There's about a year's waiting list on a lot of this stuff. There's about a year's waiting list on some of the earth moving equipment. There's sometimes over a year's waiting to get the big rubber tires to replace on these equipment. There's such an increasing demand for all this equipment that you can't just turn production on.
I see. And you're just talking about the extraction side of it. In other words, a functioning gold mine takes a year to expand production in response to higher prices.
Sure.
I assume that if you're talking about exploration, finding the gold from that time, from the time you begin to increase, you buy a bunch of those data sets and go looking, to the time that gold is in the market, what's that? Is that 5 years, 6 years, 10 years?
That's 5 to 8 years.
I see. So you don't have, I just want to sort of speak in economics terms here for a second. You'll understand, the audience, if you took economics and you probably remember the supply and the demand curve, the demand for gold is largely a function of the problem of overproduction of paper money. So when paper money is in excess, the demand curve for gold shifts right. But what I'm hearing from you, Ron, is that the supply curve takes 5 or 8 years to shift right, to match that. And so during that period of time, you have a real disequilibrium problem with gold prices, and gold prices can remain relatively high before production can catch up with consumption, with demand.
My frustration with the industry that I love dearly is that you're working hard to satisfy a spike in the gold market, and by the time you get into production, you're confronted with a nickel boom.
You're confronted with a what? I'm sorry, say that again.
With a nickel boom or a zinc boom.
Yeah, they come. You tend to find them together, right? It's not just a matter of a gold mine. You're pulling ore out of the ground, you melt it down, and you might get gold and nickel and zinc. Is that correct?
Gold might occur as a trace element from some of the base metal mines, but there are different geological environments. If you're looking for copper, generally, you might find copper and zinc and lead, but you normally wouldn't find gold. You might find a trace of silver and some trace of gold, but
I see.
They're not normally mutually comfortable with each other.
I see. All right. It's not like with oil. If you find oil, you're probably going to find some natural gas and vice versa. Yeah. It's not that situation. I see.
Oh, no. It's a bit, if you're looking for gold, you won't find coal.
All right, so you're causing me to revise my gold price outlook a little bit. I wasn't aware that the delays were this extensive. I wonder to what a degree the fact that my impression. Let me back up for a second. I'm gonna give you my impression, then we take a break, and then you tell me if I'm all wet or not. My impression is that a lot of the mineral deposits around the world, I'm considering an oil, a mineral as well, are in places in the earth that are under state control. That even if it's a private miner doing the extraction, some warlord or some central government essentially controls or has nationalized that land asset. I want to know if that's right, number one, and if it is, what impact that has on our ability to extract gold from the ground. I'm Jerry Boyer. You're listening to American Entrepreneur. We're talking gold with a fourth-generation gold miner, the great-grandson of a prospector during the Eureka gold find, during the Eureka era of finding gold in Western Australia. His name is Ron Manners, and he and I will be back in just a moment on American Entrepreneur Radio. Welcome back to the program. My name is Jerry Boyer. We're talking with Ron Manners from Mancow, which is a gold mining. Are you extraction, exploration,
Jerry, Mancow is the Economic Education Foundation.
Sorry. Yeah. All right.
My background, and I'm still consulting in the mining industry. That my background is mining.
Got it.
And that's what drew me into economics, because it's inseparable.
How much of the gold reserves in the world, the proven reserves in the world, are under land owned completely as private property, as opposed to state owned or controlled enterprises?
I have no idea of that particular statistic, but in most countries, it's a rare situation where you have a freehold title, where you own the mineral rights. It's not common. It has existed in Australia and still exists in a few restricted areas, but generally you're dealing with a government of some kind. I know in Australia, for instance, the various states control the minerals.
And I see.
When the mining companies pay a royalty, they don't pay the royalty to the central government, which is in Canberra, which is like your Washington. Right. The royalties are not payable to a central or federal government. The royalties are paid to each separate state, and each separate state has a mining act under which all the resources are governed, and that's quite manageable. We've got a very good mining act in Western Australia, and that's been modelled. If you go to Eritrea, for instance, you read the mining act there, and it's a dead steal from the Western Australian mining act, because it's so successful and effective. All we need as miners, all we need to know what the rules are, and we work within the rules, and we discourage changing the rules in the middle of the game.
So what I'm hearing from you is that even when the property itself is privately owned, the mineral rights are generally not. So there's a kind of a violation of private property there. I also am wondering, I mean, you think about the typical third world country, it's hard to imagine that if gold is found someplace, that it's not nationalized pretty quickly. So, I mean, the same with oil deposits around the world. They might have been privately owned at some point, but pretty soon the government comes along and says, no, that's ours now. We get to sell it. Now, given that situation, does that help or hurt? I mean, I guess, you know, on the one hand, it's government and it's inefficient, but on the other hand, it's government and it's greedy. So do they get out of the way enough to let private resources extract the gold? And do they, do they just kind of go about the business of divvying up the revenues as opposed to trying to explore it themselves and imposing government inefficiencies on it?
I think the successful countries are the ones that that have got reasonable people putting the deals together. I know that until recently, Ghana in West Africa has been one of the most successful countries, and I think the the rule has been that anyone that mines anything in Ghana, you have the Ghanaian government as a, I think at this stage it was a 20% owner of whatever it is. So they're your joint venture partner for up to 20%. Now that's fine, but I think there's moves to change the rules from 20% to 35% or something extreme. All that if you've done your feasibility studies on the basis of 20% and someone wants to change it to 35% in the middle of the game, the game's just about over, and that's when you get your people and your capital and you put them back on the next plane and you go somewhere else.
Right. Well, it's the Laffer curve, right? They'll get fewer revenues from their higher rate of taxation. They're in danger of killing the goose that lays the golden egg. And I'm wondering how much that is restricting. I mean, if you had a genuinely free market in gold exploration and extraction, I assume you could have huge productivity gains. You could have 5, 10, 15% increases in productivity per year to keep up with the added demand. I don't know exactly what numbers, but any other, when industries are allowed to be free, the productivity gains can be extraordinary. But this industry isn't entirely free. So what kind, given the amount of restriction, what kind of production gains can we reasonably expect? We've had huge increases in gold prices, but as you say, it's tough to respond to those prices quickly. So what can we get 5% increases in gold's annual gold production or 10%? What's reasonable given the fact we have a semi-socialist system?
I would aim for 10 to 12% per annum increase, thinking that you'll have your good years. You'll have a year when the price doubles, and you'll have one of those windows of opportunity where your costs will remain the same and your selling price will double. These are opportunities for you to accumulate some capital so you can be ready for the next period. Once the price goes up, all your costs go up, of course. The cost of production of gold used to think of it as being $100 an ounce. The average cost of production of gold now is $1,000 an ounce. So it's
why
the costs follow very, very quickly behind. It's not. I'm not saying the costs are unreasonable. It's mainly caused by scarcity. We've got such a scarcity of people in Australia. That there's not enough focus on bringing skilled people into Australia. We seem to be bringing a lot of unskilled people who immediately become welfare recipients, but we should instead be bringing in skilled labour. But I'm afraid that some of the unions don't like the competition of bringing skilled labour in from other countries, so that there's a little bit of restriction there. So somebody's standing on the hose.
Plus, there's a nearly universal tendency among developed nations to take intelligent young people and shunt them towards college and middle management and administration, as opposed to sort of a managerial class, as opposed to a technical class.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. We do have too many lawyers.
And maybe even accountants. I'm a former accountant and economist, and not enough people who can actually do technical things. And I suppose that's kind of a problem as well. And I suppose you look at, South Africa is a huge gold producer, obviously. Well, that's an extremely, at this point, the unions are basically running South Africa. They have tremendous political power. So high levels of unionization seems to me that, I saw it here where I live in Pittsburgh with the steelworker union. The steel industry was growing and the unions could get increases in wages, and that was all well and good. But at one point they got unrealistically greedy and they demanded so much that they destroyed that industry. And, that might be happening with the South African gold mining industry or some of the other places where you have high levels of unionization. In countries that are mining countries. Unionization is a problem, isn't it?
We should make reading history compulsory. That's what happened to the shipbuilding industry in Scotland, in Glasgow, and places in Scotland. The shipbuilding no longer exists. It's gone. It's gone to Korea.
Yes. Yeah, Baltimore shipbuilding industry. Philadelphia, where, I grew up near Philadelphia. Shipbuilding basically, why did it go away? Theft, graft, extremely high wage rates, make work jobs, no show jobs. No one wants to put up with that kind of thing. And I suppose that affects your industry as well. And so I'm surprised that we can get 10 to 12% per annum, growth with a situation like that. But I guess the technological gains, the ability to find new gold reserves, maybe to some degree, counters those rising labor costs and inefficiencies.
Yeah. I think that's where they're called precious metals.
Yes.
They're hard to find.
They're hard to find. And greatly in demand at the moment. So, I've learned a lot from this, Ron. This has really helped me. I'm going to maybe go back and revise some of my conclusions. I've taken the gold production process as essentially static, not because I thought it was static, but because I just didn't know enough about it to know whether it was or not. And what I'm hearing from you is that we can probably get some pretty strong gains in production of gold. We're not gonna mine gold as quickly as we print dollars and euros, but we might mine it faster than I thought so. And I think we have to take that into account in terms of the price of gold. But on the other hand, you've also taught me that there is a real problem with elasticity and agility, and that even if gold production can go up, it takes a while for the production to catch up with the demand and the higher prices.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well, Jerry.
All right. Well, this has been very helpful to me, Ron. And I want to let everyone know that you can visit Ron's website. He runs the Mankow Educational Foundation. It's a free market think tank in Australia. What's the URL for that, Ron? How can people find you?
The three W's and then Mankow, MANNKAL.
MANNKAL.org, or they can Facebook friend you, right?
Sure. Ron Manners on Facebook.
Yep. He's one of my friends too. So if you Facebook me, you'll see Ron in the list, and you get a lot of a sense of what's going on in this in a part of the world, Australia, which is very important economically. It's a very important bridge between the growth of Asia, but a Western value system and English language. It's an important hinge in the spread of freedom around the world. Ron Manners, thanks so much for your work, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Pleasure, Jerry. Anytime.
I'm Jerry Boyer. You've been listening to American Entrepreneur Radio on 1360 WMNY.